The history of the 60s has, for the most part, been written by the 60s generation itself. Hippies, anti-war protesters, civil rights activists. But there is a new history that's emerging, written by younger historians who don't have those battle scars or fits of nostalgia. Rick Perlstein is one of the leaders of this new crop of historians. In his books Before the Storm and Nixon Land, he argues that the biggest story of the 60s may actually be the rise of the modern conservative movement.
Probably the most lasting change to our political institutions and the way we think about politics in the 1960s was the rise of this backlash against liberalism. The rise of a politician like a Nixon, like a Reagan, like, in fact, the entire right wing of the Republican Party, who appeal to the voter based on the idea that they are going to make you safe and secure in a world that no longer seems safe, no longer seems secure.
Before we go too far into this discussion, we really ought to point out you lay claim to being a liberal yourself. That doesn't mean, though, that you're going to be easy on anyone in this discussion, does it?
Well, people like Abby Hoffman and Tim Hayden come in for a bit of abuse in this book. I find them often quite puerile, self-centered, narcissistic. They made it really easy to reject the left in the 60s and the early 70s. I mean, I tell a story about Abby Hoffman. Basically, he was hired by John Lindsay, the liberal mayor of New York, as a liaison to the hippie community. And part of the deal was that he couldn't be arrested. So Abby Hoffman used to bait the cops into trying to get them to arrest him, even though they knew they couldn't arrest him. And at one point, I tell a story about how he was in the precinct house, and he was totally stoned, of course, and he smashed the precinct's prized trophy case where they kept all their, you know, their regimental decorations. I mean, this was not an act of peace and love. It was an act of anger and resentment.
This, of course, exists on both sides of the story. I'm fascinated, in fact, by what you write about as one of the crucial moments of this, and that's Ronald Reagan running for governor in California. I still don't have a great sense of who he was at that time, but certainly he grasped that the country as a whole was not the liberal monolith that everybody thought was pushing through LBJ's agenda.
Absolutely. Ronald Reagan is a fascinating figure, and I would even say, despite all the imprecations against his intelligence, a political genius. He was the guy who understood that these disorders were actually issues that you can win an election on. He was the first guy to understand that. In fact, his aides would tell him, stop talking about the student uprising at Berkeley. It doesn't show up on our polls. No one cares about the student uprising at Berkeley. And Reagan said, I don't care what your polls say. Every time I mention it, I get a standing ovation. And what happens there is an act of political genius, because Ronald Reagan is basically understanding a new emergent political issue. So new, in fact, that people didn't even know it was something that they could vote based on. So he talks about Berkeley. He talks about orgies so vile I can't even describe them to you. He talks about how Pat Brown, who's the governor he's running against, hasn't picked up these kids by the scruff of their neck. And by the way, Ronald Reagan is remembered as a figure of sunny optimism. But at least during this period, he really focused his rage. He would say things like, hippie is someone who looks like Jane, dresses like Tarzan, and smells like cheetah. You know, someone would hold up a sign saying, make love, not war. And he would say, you don't look like you could do it either. In fact, in the photo section of my book, Nixon Land, I chose a picture of Ronald Reagan, basically his face scrunched up in rage. And that was really the Ronald Reagan who ran for governor in 1966 in California and who won.
You describe this as a period during which the Democrats really didn't understand what was going on. They simply didn't get what Reagan was doing. But what about Richard Nixon? Did he understand what Reagan was accomplishing?
Richard Nixon went to school on Ronald Reagan. In 1966, it was a key year for Richard Nixon's comeback. But what he didn't do was speak about the backlash. He really didn't have a feel for it. It's only the next year, 1967, witnessing how well Reagan does with it, and by the way, George Wallace too, that he begins to pick up this language, this idea that there is a war between black and white in America, and he kind of casts himself as the field marshal almost for the white side.
Looking back, you know, we hear all of the stories of the march in Selma, of Martin Luther King, of the death of Bobby Kennedy, and ignore what was going on, not just in California, but around the country. There really was a change in the way that people were viewing politics. How much of that was an innate change, and how much of it was manipulated?
Manipulated by Richard Nixon, you mean? Yes.
By Nixon and his staff. There were people who were working with him who seemed to know what buttons to push, if you will.
Well, let me give you an example of the manipulation. When in 1970, Richard Nixon was campaigning for congressional candidates and Senate candidates, they had a very specific trick they would do. Whenever he was giving a speech or a campaign rally, they would let in several dozen anti-war protesters because they knew the anti-war protesters would use foul language, they might throw something at the podium, and then Richard Nixon could use that act as the subtext, not even the subtext, as the subject for his speech. And one of the first memos he got when he was president was a warning that that spring in 1969, there would be campus uprisings of a passion and violence that hadn't been seen before. And he didn't write on the memo, "How can we prevent this?" He wrote on the memo, "Good," because he knew the more passion, the more division, the more anger there was, the better he would do politically. Now, he didn't create the wave, but he did a very effective job of surfing the wave.
Looking back at the story that you tell, it is frankly hard to tell the good guys from the bad guys. Everybody is behaving well. Everybody's behaving badly. Is that a typical story of politics?
I think the 1960s was a time in which nothing was banal. Nothing was boring. Everything was outsized. Everything was the end of the world. Everything was apocalyptic. There was this constant transit between the Lyndon Johnson attitude that we were living in the best of all possible worlds and we were going to enter a new Jerusalem. In fact, when he lit the White House Christmas tree in 1964, he said these are the most hopeful times since Christ was born in Bethlehem. And on the other side, that we were about to face an apocalypse. And there was always this tacking between the two. It was always an age of extremes.
So is that the lesson from all of that? Is that what the contemporary politician can get from looking back, that there are different lessons to be learned from the 60s than we thought there were?
Well, the Republicans chose the lesson from the 1960s that this sort of politicking is effective. It works. David Frum, the former White House speechwriter, in his book on how conservatives can come out of their political doldrums, says, "We've been running the exact same presidential campaign since 1972. I mean, we've been running against the hippies. You know, we've been running against the black militants." But at least he argues that the success of that sort of politics fades with each passing day. That's really the question of this 2008 presidential election. Is this mode of politics that Richard Nixon bequeathed to the country still something that the Republicans can squeeze juice from?
Rick Perlstein is an independent historian in Chicago. His latest book is Nixonland: The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America.